We are not in a recession. We're not. But it is getting kind of recession-ish out there, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, the 5th day of July. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. How about we start today with a little game of choose your own economic adventure, or perhaps more accurately, choose your own economic misadventure. With the caveat, again, that we are not in one yet, I offer for your consideration today two indicators that a recession might be in. The offing might, of course, being the operative phrase there. Indicator number one, oil just getting crushed today. The U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate down 8% on the session, $99.68 a barrel. Fears of a slowing economy means less oil demand. Prices thus react accordingly. Indicator number two, and I'm going to try to do this without getting wonky on you. I don't know if it's going to work, but I'm going to try. A part of the yield curve, that is, the different interest rates that the various denominations of Treasury bonds pay, part of the yield curve inverted today. Instead of longer bonds, the 10-year in this case, carrying higher yields than shorter bonds, the 2-year for us today, the yield curve at one point today went the other way around. It inverted. Now, do either of those things in and of themselves mean a recession is coming? No. Maybe? Yes. Okay. Elsewhere in this economy, there is news of tariffs and of President Biden thinking still about rolling back some of those Trump-era China tariffs. The president is honestly kind of betwixt and between his advisors on this one. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has said they are a drag on the economy. Trade Representative Katherine Tai says and has said on this program that actually the tariffs are leveraged to persuade Beijing to change its economic ways. Really, though, here's what we want to know. You probably, too. What might cutting those tariffs mean for consumers? Marketplace's Lily Jamali is first up.
Before we get to that, a reminder about why the U.S., under President Trump, imposed tariffs on China in the first place. The point, says Georgetown Law's Jennifer Hillman, was to create leverage.
In order to try to have a negotiation with China to address the things that were at issue in the very beginning.
Namely, allegations of unfair trade practices and the theft of intellectual property.
My concern is that it seems like the tariffs have stayed on, but there isn't much in the way of ongoing conversations or negotiations happening right now with China.
Tariffs remain in place on a range of Chinese imports, from components used in manufacturing to consumer goods like toys and clothing. And that's where Hillman says the Biden administration should consider removing tariffs if China does the same. Will consumers notice? No, says Derek Scissors of the Conservative American Enterprise Institute.
Inflation is being driven by gas, food, and housing, none of which are going to be affected by the tariffs.
But lifting some tariffs could start to change public perceptions on inflation, says Gary Huffbauer of the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Would it be eye-popping? No, we're not claiming that. It would be just something in the direction of tangibly reducing inflationary pressures in the U.S. economy.
Huffbauer says presidents don't have a lot of power to control inflation. This is one lever the Biden administration can pull right now. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Should you have been anywhere near the U.S. commercial aviation system this past holiday weekend? Well, our condolences. More than 2,000 flights were canceled, more than 25,000 delayed. And you might have seen it's been terrible over in Europe for a month now. Or more, airlines everywhere have been struggling with staffing shortages as demand soars back to pre-pandemic levels. And as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports, turbulence is going to continue.
Peter McNally, an analyst with Third Bridge Group, says the aviation industry's troubles come down to three C's.
Capacity, captains, and cancellations.
Airlines have been slow to add back capacity because they can't hire enough captains, that is, pilots, which leads to cancellations.
It's a mess, as everyone can see.
The Airline Pilots Association declined an interview, but said in a statement, quote, "This is not a labor-created problem. It's an airline mismanagement issue." Aviation analyst and consultant Robert Mann says the airlines received more than $50 billion in government funding to shore up staffing during the pandemic. But the industry still lost hundreds of thousands of workers.
The attempt to rehire those folks and get them all qualified and security cleared is creating a unique problem.
Airlines blamed a shortage of air traffic controllers in a June letter to the administration. The Federal Aviation Administration said in a statement there is no system-wide shortage of air traffic controllers, though there have been isolated staffing issues at a few locations. In both cases, shortages are likely to persist for some time, says Henry Hartevelt, a travel industry analyst.
You have to submit your application, go through background checks that include a security check, pass drug tests, the interview process, and more.
He says it could take until 2025 for staffing levels to catch up, unless a slowing economy cuts the demand for travel. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it was bad, till it wasn't. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you're wondering how companies might react to a recession, look no further than 441 9th Avenue in Manhattan, the home of Peloton, the home workout company that, having fallen on leaner times, has put as much as 100,000 square feet of office space up for sublease. That's according to BizNow, by the way, which tracks commercial real estate. And it comes after Peloton laid off about 20% of its staff. Now, yes, Peloton was having troubles before worries of a recession crept into the economic ether. But CEOs across the country are asking themselves now what expenses they can cut if they have to. And in this era of remote and a hybrid work, the answer is increasingly, hey, how about the office? Marketplace's Matt Levin has that one.
Micah Remley is the CEO of Robin, a company that does hybrid work consulting. He says he's getting the same question from worried CEOs these days. If I give up on trying to get employees back to the office full time, how much money can I save?
Typically, office space is your second largest expense after employee costs.
Remley says if the pandemic hasn't convinced executives to let go of the corner office for good, an economic downturn might do the trick.
So a lot of people are coming to terms with that right now, and this potentially is a cost savings measure going into a recession.
Of course, companies can't just downsize their office space overnight. Many are stuck in long-term leases, sometimes 10, 15, 20 years. But Alex Cohen with the real estate brokerage Compass says the pandemic has changed that, too.
The typical lease term went down significantly. The moves that were still made when COVID was really rampant generally were shorter term.
Think three-year commitments as opposed to more than a decade. That means in a few years, office buildings may be even more empty than they are now. The office vacancy rate is already over 18%. That's according to Victor Kalinog, who researches commercial real estate at Moody's Analytics.
Well, the historic record was 19.7% back in 1991. We might break that historic record.
See, the 90s really are back, except with Zoom. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson finds himself once again on the brink of political disaster. I guess you're at the brink, right? Two of his cabinet secretaries, the health secretary and the chancellor of the exchequer, that's the treasury secretary, they resigned today in the wake of, well, you can only call it a whole lot of scandals over there. Also weighing on the prime minister's fortunes, though, inflation running even hotter in the UK than it is here, 9.1%, and that has sparked a wave of backlash against the government. What, though, about the small businesses in the UK that are doing all they can to just stay in business? Samantha Wallace runs a honey stall in the Borough Market over in London. It's called From Field and Flower. We've been talking to her for, I guess, a couple of years now. Hi, Sam. It's Kai. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm well. Sorry to be late.
No problem.
How are things at the honey stall?
Speaking, they're fine. It's kind of, I was saying to a friend, it's a bit like pushing a boulder uphill at the moment. We're kind of ticking along, But, you know, Brexit, I'm sure you'll hear about Brexit always anyway. But yeah. And then over here, we've got something that they're calling cheerfully the cost of living crisis. Everything just feels a bit difficult at the moment, a bit like wading through treacle, just when you really want it to feel easy.
So, yeah, well, my first clue was you saying you were pushing a boulder uphill. Let's talk about that whole cost of living crisis, known in American English as inflation. It's higher over there than it is over here, like 9-something%. The Bank of England says you're looking at 11% at some point. That cannot be good for you as a business.
No, it's not. It's not. I mean, essentially, it will start to hit the kind of people that come to the market mm-hmm. for pleasure because it's a fun thing to do, you know, a day out with the family. Being in London is not necessarily a cheap day out. And so that's a worry. And then more pertinently, we have a fuel bill that is just extortionate. Our petrol is up at £2 now for a litre, which I think it's almost tripled in cost to fill up, basically.
Yeah, so £2 is, I don't even know off the top of my head, probably what, $2.50-ish, £2?
Right? I would say so, yes, at a guess, yeah. You know, on average, yes.
Right, so $2.50 a litre, that's $10 a gallon, which is steep. Let me ask you something, though. Back up for a minute to people shopping at Borough Market. Have you raised prices with inflation at 9-something%?
We've actually just had to, for the first time, raise our Italian honey prices. It's kind of one of those things we tried to put it off, but we're going to have to just do it now and hope that that's, you know, that works, basically.
Are you worried about staying in business?
No, optimistically, no, not particularly. I guess I'm worried about how long can we kind of ride this road that feels like quite bumpy. But I mean, I think we can pivot to things. We introduced a pet line, specifically kind of very gourmet dog treats. And there will always be people, I guess, who love honey. But we might look at a future where perhaps we're more limited in what we bring in and just how much variety we have. But optimistically, I like to think that, you know, we're in a really good spot in Borough. It's a beautiful place. It's very popular.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There will always be people coming. So hopefully it's just enough.
I look forward to getting back there. Let me ask you the labor question. Obviously, labor over here, super tight. It's you know, two job openings for every one person. Wages are going up. What about over there?
Well, there's a lot of vacancies, as I understand it, more generally. And we've just had it happen that, yes, some of our longstanding kind of part-timers are just moving on. Mm. And so we've just been replacing people. It's been really tricky. We used to get lots and lots of CVs. And this time we've been actually almost super desperate. We've landed on our feet. Essentially, we've got two lovely ladies working for us now, but they're both very new. It's their first ever jobs, which is great because they're super moldable, but also, you know, it's their first ever jobs. That's quite a lot to take in. So we've been quite lucky, but it just the normal routes have failed totally.
I don't know that I've ever asked you this in the number of years we've been speaking. Is running a business all you thought it would be? Is it harder? Is it worth it? What do you think?
Oh, I don't know. I was quite nervous about setting up a business. My parents were both self-employed and had different businesses. So I'm aware, I guess, of the costs and the strain. But I think it's hard when you really care about something. I think it's that thing if you never switch off. I think that's the only downside. But other than that, no regrets. Absolutely not. I love it. And I'm optimistic about the future. I always am.
Fair enough. And that's good to hear, actually. If you find yourself in London's Borough Market, swing by Samantha's shop. It's called From Field and Flower. And pick yourself up some honey or some dog treats, I suppose. Pet treats. Sam, thanks a lot. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Take care. Talk to you soon. Coming up.
We essentially lost all the larvae in the entire hatchery.
Can't imagine that was a good thing, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 129 today, 0.4%, closed at 30,967. The NASDAQ up 194 points, 1.75%, finished at 11,322. The S&P 500 up 6 points, not quite 0.2%, 38.31. As oil prices fell, so too did oil company share prices. ExxonMobil slumped 3.1%. Marathon Oil gave up 6.3%. Bond prices up. Yield on the 10-year Tino down to 2.82%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. You have heard, I will guess, maybe here, maybe elsewhere, about something called universal basic income, programs that give people cash to spend fundamentally however they want. There are also guaranteed income programs that focus on people usually on the margins of this economy, people just out of prison or low-income mothers. Now, organizations in a couple of cities, New York and San Francisco, to name just two of them, are piloting those kinds of programs for artists, guaranteed income to support people's jobs. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
It was the beginning of the pandemic, and McKinley West was frustrated. His DJ jobs dried up overnight, which means his income had too. So Mickey Breeze, that's his DJ name, did the only thing he could think of. He wrote a song about it.
Yeah. They tell me more money, more problems. Baby, I disagree. It's no money, all problems in the life that we lead. Like money came by happiness, you should come shopping with me. The sad truth is the better things in life ain't free.
Literally all of these problems that you have with family, with cars, with mental health, with content can in some shape, way, or form be solved with money. And I hate it when people demonize it.
West sold off thousands of dollars of speakers, DJ controllers, and synthesizers to pay his bills. And then, just when he thought he'd hit the bottom, he got an email from Springboard for the Arts, a nonprofit in Minnesota, saying he'd been selected for its guaranteed income pilot. $500 a month for 18 months. No strings attached.
I've literally been using it to restart or kickstart my career from a bit of a dead zone.
West bought back his DJ equipment. He put some money into maintaining his SUV, which he uses to haul gear to events, and some of the stipend has gone to basics like groceries. This is one of the things that can make income programs controversial. Recipients aren't necessarily required to use the money in a specific way. They don't even have to put it towards making art. Amy Castro co-directs the Center for Guaranteed Income Research at the University of Pennsylvania, which is partnering with the pilot in Minnesota.
No, people aren't required to sort of continue to demonstrate that they are producing a particular art piece or that there's no juried competition to see who is producing the better public art installation.
To qualify for the program in Minnesota, artists had to show they'd been adversely affected by the pandemic. Artists of color were prioritized, but beyond that, recipients were selected at random. Castro says that's the whole point, to not decide whether an artist is good or bad, but to give them an opportunity to grow.
The existing art world functions not on trying to create space and equality around sort of who gets to produce, who gets access to funding, who gets gallery space. And what these projects are offering is something completely different.
But like any experiment, the private foundations funding these programs will want to understand the results, which means the programs have to measure some kind of outcome. Sarah Calderon is the executive director of Creatives Rebuild New York.
Does it help them produce more work, to participate in more shows? Does it help them get the next grant, get the next thing, right?
Creatives Rebuild New York has two income pilots, a guaranteed income program and an employment program that gives artists a $65,000 salary per year for 2 years. Playwright Jessie J. Hoon was chosen to work on new productions and community events for Asian Americans with Mayi Theater Company in New York City. It means no more 3 a.m. writing sessions to work around his daytime admin job. Creating is now his full-time job.
Which is one of the most valuable things for an artist is just having the time to really flesh out your process and your creative work.
And he admits he's really looking forward to the health insurance benefit.
The first thought I had was, oh my God, I can get new glasses. I can get a teeth cleaning.
He says that will give him the mental space he needs to make better work. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
The big Supreme Court decision last week, West Virginia versus EPA, was about a whole lot more than just what the executive branch can do to regulate the pollution that is warming this planet. We talked about it that day, what the decision means for the administrative state and how this entire economy runs. But yes, in the short term, the White House now does have a trickier path to trying to control climate change. And while the politics and bureaucracy of that decision play out, the earth is being damaged now in real time. Case in point for us today, the oceans. The World Meteorological Organization reported earlier this year that, thanks to us, humans, right, oceans are the most acidic they've been in 26,000 years. And that is going to have economic consequences, particularly as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports for the shellfish industry.
Whiskey Creek Oyster Hatchery is on the Oregon coast. This is where baby oysters are hatched and raised and then sold to oyster farms throughout the Pacific Northwest.
Hi, this is Alan Barton at Whiskey Creek. And the sound you're hearing is our pumps pumping in about 200 gallons a minute of seawater into the hatchery.
Barton is the production manager there. The seawater comes in, gets treated, goes into tanks where the oysters are hatched. Barton grows vats of green and brown algae to feed them. After nearly 30 years of doing this, back in 2007, something started to go wrong. Entire crops of baby oysters, normally swimming around, just died.
We thought the causes were things like bacteria, disease.
So they treated the water for bacteria.
2008, we essentially lost all the larvae in the entire hatchery, $100,000 worth of product, and just all went to the bottom, all within 48 hours or so.
The cause, it turned out, was the water itself. More acidic water from deeper in the ocean was upwelling into their water source, driven by seasonal winds. The lower pH, meaning more acidic water, was driving changes in the mineral composition of the water, killing the oyster babies. Deeper water is naturally more acidic than surface water, and upwelling is a natural event. But human-caused emissions are increasing the background level of acidity and may have tipped those natural conditions just past what the oyster larva could bear.
The ocean takes up about 25 to 30% of the carbon dioxide that is emitted. And in doing so, it lowers the pH of the ocean.
George Waldbusser is professor of ocean ecology and biogeochemistry at Oregon State University.
It also lowers something we call saturation state, which is how corrosive the water is to calcium carbonate minerals or shells.
He says the pH of open ocean water has fallen since CO2 emissions ramped up with industry about 100 years ago, from 8.1 to 8.0.
It sounds small, but what that actually translates to is a 30% increase in acidity.
Shannon Misek studies the effects of CO2 in the water. She's a research chemist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Milford, Connecticut.
What you're hearing in the background is water that is being dosed with carbon dioxide to simulate the effects of ocean acidification.
She's grown surf clams, sea scallops, oysters, and currently bay scallops. Adult oysters are pretty resilient to acidification, but baby oysters basically have to fight the water for minerals to grow their shells. They use up their energy reserves and die of starvation trying. And Misek's research shows lowering the pH affects the physiology of a variety of shelled animals.
And this is resulting in less energy that's available for them to grow.
Shells were smaller, and in some cases, like with surf clams, their insides were stunted.
They were also putting on less meat muscle, and you eat the meat.
Translating all of this into economic costs is not straightforward. For example, some shellfish may be able to evolve resistance to acidification. Some hatcheries are trying to breed resistance, and there's a lot of natural variability in acidity from place to place. Jeremy Testa is an associate professor at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science.
The vulnerability to acidification is pretty different across space.
Oyster hatcheries in the Chesapeake Bay don't face the same problems as those in Oregon, for example. And hatcheries like Whiskey Creek have managed to treat their water for minimal cost once they figured out the problem, though that took a few years and hundreds of thousands of dollars in losses. But ultimately, the cost of ocean acidification is maybe best understood as simply being one more problem to deal with, on top of a pile of problems created or made worse by humans. Dr. Meredith White is Director of Research and Development at Mook Sea Farm in Maine.
In the last couple of years, we have had other changes to the ecosystem of the water that is pumped into our hatchery that have really affected our seed oyster production.
Increased rainfall diluting the coastal water, changes in the algae that led to baby oysters being poisoned, wild swings in oxygen and CO2 levels, all of them driven, at least in part, White says, by human emissions or pollution. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, we talk every now and then about the dollar being the global reserve currency, right? And yes, someday the dollar might not be the reserve anymore, but not, says the Federal Reserve Bank of New York in a report out today, anytime soon. No currency replicates the characteristics of the U.S. dollar as a store of value, unit of account, and medium of exchange, the New York Fed says. Also, they say, moreover, U.S. assets are viewed to be safe and liquid and have withstood the effects of global shocks. Sometimes, like today, I just talk too much, so we don't have time for a moment of economic context. My bad. Sorry. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Mienten, and Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.